Good afternoon. My name is Amelia Maria de la Luz Montes. I'm an associate professor of English and the director of ethnic studies here at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Welcome to the 37th Interdisciplinary Symposium sponsored by the Center for Great Plains Studies here. Today's symposium, Diverse Faces, Shared Histories, Immigrants on the Great Plains, has already featured this morning and continues to feature this afternoon national and state scholars and writers speaking on various aspects regarding the history, politics, and personal narratives on immigration. Native, Asian, African American, and Latina perspectives vary yet share overlapping histories. This symposium is designed to educate and broaden our perspectives about immigration on the Great Plains. This symposium has been a year in the making, and it's been a pleasure working with the staff at the Center for Great Plains Studies and with the speakers that you will be hearing today. I'd first like to introduce our moderator for this afternoon, Dr. Andrew Graybill. Andrew Graybill is Associate Professor of History at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, specializing in the history of the North American West. His first book, Policing the Great Plains, Rangers, Mounties, and the North American Frontier, 1875 to 1910, is a comparative study of the two most famous constabularies in the world. He is working on his second project, which explores the construction of racial identity in the U.S. by considering the experiences of a single family of mixed Native and white ancestry in 19th century Montana. At UNL, he teaches courses in the United States, the West, Canada, and the environment. It is a great pleasure to introduce to you today's moderator, Andrew Graybill.
Good afternoon. Especially recognize Amelia Montes, who has done such a nice job in doling out thanks to the rest of us who are involved, but it was really Amelia who quarterbacked this from the very beginning, and the smooth running of this morning's session in the packed house this afternoon, I think, is a real testament to her hard work. So thank you, Amelia. Those of you who are here this morning, the format this afternoon is just a bit different. Instead of having a panel, a conversation that will then conclude with sort of a joint question and answer period, instead we'll do first one talk, followed by a break, a short break of about 15 minutes, followed by the second. And I'll introduce both. But I will start with Sergio Walls, who received his licenciatura in political science from the Instituto Tecnológico Autónomo de México, and his PhD in political science from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Since 2009, Sergio has been an assistant professor of political science here at UNL. His dissertation, Immigrants' Political Suitcases, A Theory of Imported Socialization, is a study of how immigrants' prior political experiences affect their political assimilation, attitudes, and behaviors once in the United States. His research on the emergence of partisan attachments among immigrants to the U.S. is forthcoming in the Political Research Quarterly. Additionally, his co-authored work on 20th century news coverage of American wars received the American Political Science Association's Paul Lazarsfeld Award. His talk today is Pursuing the Dream, an Immigrant Story. Please join me in welcoming Professor Sergio Walls.
Thank you very much. I gotta say, it's really interesting for a professor who joined the academia because of shyness to have such a large crowd. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Thank you, Amelia, for your hard work, for leading us to this great event. Thank you to the Center of the Great Plains. I gotta say, I'm gonna start with just a little reflection, because when people asked me to be one of the solo speakers for the afternoon session, obviously I'm always eager to participate. That's what assistant professors do, after all. But at the same time, I was reluctant because I'm a very private person. And my first reaction was, why should I be sharing any of my personal story? what good is it going to come out of that? And I'm going to try to keep the personal anecdotes to a minimum, but I'm going to use them to illustrate certain points that I think need to be made. With that said, I also need to say that when I was leaving grad school, my mentor said, as an assistant professor, make sure you work hard. You work hard. You work hard. You publish. And you keep quiet until you get tenure. So I'm breaking that last rule because I've been working hard, working hard, working hard, and already getting into publishing. But today, I take the chance to not be silent. This talk, I structured it with three components. The first component is going to be more of a theoretical framework. After all those years, getting a PhD, it's hard to shake. And the second component will have a little bit more of the personal anecdotes, highlighting some of the basis for my third part of the talk, which will have some suggestions, policy recommendations. And yes, to those former students and current students of mine, you'll be surprised. You know how little I always, like how much I avoid to talk about my own opinion ever. Sorry about that. Today you'll hear it probably for the first time. So the first part of this talk, I call it Why Immigration? Why the Heartland? Why Now? But before I start that, let me set the tone for the talk. I'm borrowing from Portes and Rumbaugh. Immigrants do not come to escape perennial unemployment or destitution in their homeland. Most undertake the journey instead to attain the dream of a new lifestyle that has reached their countries, but that is impossible to fulfill in them. Not surprisingly, the most determined individuals, those who feel the distance between actual reality and life goals most poignantly, often choose migration as the path to resolve this contradiction. These following reflections, these following words, are intended to portray both an academic and a personal perspective on immigration at a time when the debate is heated. And these words are dedicated to all of those who for centuries now had come to America leaving everything behind, pursuing the dream of freedom and a better life. My dedication, of course, includes those who have died in the desert. In a journey through the desert, trying to reach this promised land. It is my most sincere hope that at least some of these insights can help foster and nurture an intelligent debate of ideas. Nothing would hurt me more than to have my ideas taken out of context and to be used to fuel already negatively charged contemporary political rhetoric. I firmly believe that both my academic and personal backgrounds best position me as a moderate voice offering common sense solutions to an issue of utmost importance in contemporary politics. However, I am well aware of the fact that common sense in politics seems to be the least common of all senses. Why immigration? Why the heartland? Why now? Let me start by stating a little bit of this theoretical framework. It is hard to try to understand why politicians try to call our attention to certain issue if we don't understand what's behind that behavior. After all, I'm a political behavior scholar, so I want to try to offer this audience a little bit of a reflection why this happens. So the answer, in my view, is twofold. Immigration is not a problem in and of itself. Strategic politicians, however, problematize it. Immigration also offers a continuous opportunity to fuel us versus them rhetoric. Let me elaborate a little further on the first point. It is important to note that socioeconomic conditions in and of themselves do not necessarily become problems in political terms. Some scholars would argue that problems within the political sphere are in fact socially constructed. In the words of Mary Edelman, problems come into discourse and therefore into existence as reinforcements of ideologies. They signify who are virtuous and useful and who are dangerous or inadequate. Moreover, some problems become highly salient, while others never even shyly scratch the surface of the political sphere. The difference, this author argues, possibly lies in the way in which these problems, once salient, are likely to affect the current balance of power. Whose power is expanded, and whose power is diminished? Edelman acknowledges that there might be cynical efforts to secure political benefits through emphasizing certain problems. However, he believes, most efforts to emphasize certain problems are in fact sincere. Here, I disagree. I do believe that more often than not, strategic politicians construct social problems so they can present themselves to the public as leaders who can effectively solve such problems as a result of their constant quest for improving their prospects of re-election. It should follow that politicians who label immigration as a problem, sincerely or not, are perhaps more interested in using the problem as a means to maintaining and even expanding electoral support than they are in effectively solving or even tangentially addressing any issues surrounding immigration. After all, by this logic, the moment the problem is solved, their leadership would neither be deemed necessary nor electorally rewarded. Regarding the second point, it should be stressed that massive immigration flows have the potential to reconfigure the ethnic makeup of any given society, triggering dormant and further ingraining active anti-immigration sentiments among such society. These sentiments can turn the public into fertile soil where politicians both cultivate and harvest from us versus them rhetoric. In other words, immigration can become a political cleavage by which society is then divided into an in-group, the natives, and an out-group, the foreign-born. In fact, this has been a recurring case in the United States even before the 13 colonies declared their independence in 1776. I will offer a couple of historical examples towards the end of this subsection, but for now, let me focus still on this theoretical component of my argument. As stated before, immigration flows have the potential to segregate society into two camps. In doing so, immigration flows have the potential to fuel and ignite racial prejudice. Following Bloomer's sociological theory of group position, there are four basic feelings which seem to be always present in race prejudice in a dominant group. Feeling of superiority. A feeling of superiority with regard to the other racial or ethnic groups. A feeling that the other is intrinsically different and alien. A feeling of proprietary claim of certain areas of privilege or advantage, and fear and suspicion that the other threatens the prerogatives of the dominant group. Now, by a show of hands, which I love to do in my classes, how many of these conditions are fulfilled when we talk about immigrants? Like, how many would you say, let's go with one, by a show of hands? Two? Three? Four? Okay, thank you very much. I thought I had already lost you. It was just a majoritarian agreement, that's good. The point of this, of bringing back the Bloomer's group position theory, it's just to highlight that this is a social phenomenon that has historic antecedents. So one of the things that I try to the best of my capacity to fight as an academic is media trends to portray this as a new phenomenon. Because it's new, because it's hot, because it's timely. Because if we portray it that way, once it's not hot, once it's not timely, then no one wants to address it anymore. But this has been an ongoing phenomenon for centuries now. And it should be understood in those precise terms. Now, I promised you a couple of historical examples, so here they are. It will take a little bit for Mr. Franklin to loathe. But he will fire. Unless a stream of these people can be turned away from their country to other countries, they will soon outnumber us so that we will not be able to save our language or our government. And as I said, it will take him a little bit to load again. Sorry about that. These words were first pronounced in 1753 in front of the Pennsylvania Assembly. And they were to address the German immigration, which at the time accounted for roughly a third of the population of the colony of Pennsylvania. Why should Pennsylvania, founded by the English, become a colony of aliens who will shortly be so numerous as to Germanize us instead of our Anglifying them? Earlier today, fortunately enough for me, I started hearing some questions regarding hope. And towards the end of my talk, I'll tell you how hopeful I am. But before I go there, I do think that it is very important. I think it was beautifully brought up by Tom's talk too. We cannot be oblivious of our history. It is in knowing our history that we become stronger. For those of you who think that after independence, because all men were created equal, everything was all right, which I know it's not the case in this audience. Back in 1902, Woodrow Wilson wrote something similar. This occasion, talking about Italians, Hungarians, men of the lowest class from the south of Italy, and men of the meaner sort out of Hungary and Poland. And he also stated, let me quote, because on this one I am very, very careful. Wilson also suggested that these immigrants had neither the skill nor the energy nor any initiative of quick intelligence. Now, this has important consequences. First, we need to recognize that it's not a new phenomenon, that we've been doing it for quite a while. Now, I would be lying if I would be telling you that this is just an American phenomenon. This is a human phenomenon worldwide. The logic of us versus them has the capacity to really gather quick and important strategic support. And I want to mention that there was a question earlier today about the relationship between Latinos, African Americans, and Asians. One of the pieces that I've enjoyed the most while I was in grad school was written by Bobowan Hutchins in 1996, and it uses this framework I'm using myself, Bloomer's theory group position, and what they basically show with some empirical evidence in Los Angeles was that this rhetoric of us versus them had similar effects among Latinos, thinking of African Americans thinking of Asians. So it extends well beyond the traditional, and let me use quotation marks, white-black divide. So again, here's where assistant professors do, and I do this actually out of a scholarly merit, but some people will have a hard time believing this because this was published by the chair of my department. But this is an award-winning book, and I bring it to your attention because just by if the title doesn't grab you, I don't know what else could. Who counts as an American? And I love a couple of the quotes in the conclusion section that speaks directly to what I've been trying to illustrate historically here. The extent to which people view their fellow Americans as prototypical, as fully American, or as marginalized, as sitting on the boundary between the in-group and the out-group, has serious consequences. Marginalized Americans are not given the same benefit of the doubt as prototypical Americans. Any help they get is often questioned. Any criticisms they offer are often rejected. And they are less likely to get support given to prototypical Americans because they don't quite fit what it means to be an American. Bethesda Moore's 2009. Let me pause here for just a second before I move on to the next part. I came to the United States almost 7 years ago, and I consider myself an American. I am proud of my origin. I will never deny my origins, and I'll get to that a little later. I was born and raised in Mexico City. I hold Mexican citizenship, but I consider myself an American. And I have one of the deepest loves you'll ever encounter for this country. Yet, because of my origin, more often than not, people are not willing to see me as a full American. And this is a key point. We usually have to hyphenate not only our last names because it comes from a different culture, we have to hyphenate Mexican American. I wish it comes a day when I can say I am an American and no one questions that. Just the same way German Americans no longer say I am a German American. Now let me continue for a moment. Why the heartland and why now? Well, if you remember, I told you that problems in politics are socially constructed. And somehow the media has rallied on this idea that this is an urgent and pressing matter, more so now than it was some other times. Let's place things in context. Here in the state of Nebraska, in 2000, we had 74,000, roughly 75,000 foreign-born people. That accounts for roughly 4.4% of the population. That's back in 2000. Estimates by the U.S. Census Bureau, 2005-2009, this population indeed increased from roughly 75,000 to roughly 99,000. I haven't seen the figures of the census 2010 yet, but this increased from 4.4 to 5.6. Now, to place that in context, the average mean in 2000 for the U.S. was 11.1, so we're way below that. In the case of the estimates on 2005-2009, that 5.6 is way below 2 because the mean at the national level was 12.5. So it is not like it is that big of a problem. It is a phenomenon. It is an influx, and we can choose to treat it as a problem or as an opportunity. If we place that in historical context with the German immigration, which I hope no one here in this state neglects the great heritage that he has had for the state, in 1850, roughly 600,000 German-born people lived in the United States, 600,000. That accounted for roughly 2.5% of the population at the time. 10 years later, those roughly 600,000 became 1,300,000, roughly. 10 years. That was a quite dramatic influx of new German foreign-born. A little later than that, by 1880, we had roughly 2 million Germans. And a little bit after that, in 1890, we had roughly slightly less than 3 million. So that figure grew by almost 6 times in 40 years. And obviously, we have heard already in some of the testimonies even earlier today that there were anti-immigration, anti-German sentiments, right? And unfortunately, there were also like burning of books in German. And this is the kind of thing that I cannot be silent against. We've seen it. It has consequences. And I would not want to see that in this state. So it's not a big of a problem as some people try to portray. Why not? Well, let me advance here something that I didn't write, but I find really compelling, so I can keep my thread of thought. A couple of sociologists offer this following conclusion in a very interesting study. The transformation of immigration from regional to a national phenomenon owes much to the enforcement strategy of prevention through deterrence adopted after 1993. Let me explain this a little bit to you. So what happens is that after 1993, the borders in Texas, specifically the one in San Antonio, and the border in San Diego in California, decided to go tough on immigration. And apparently what happened is that this, along with the economic downturn in California, started forcing immigration flows to shift pathways towards the Midwest and the South, the deeper South. So what it's interesting to me here, and I really want the audience to at least keep in mind, is that when people call for tough on immigration kind of policies, we're not really addressing the issues surrounding immigration. We might be, at best, diverting the problem to someone else. So here's where I'm going to start a little bit talking about myself. And I really appreciate your patience. The main idea, trust me, it's not easy for me to do this, but it's just to highlight how my pre-migration experience, one, facilitated my incorporation into the American fabric in so many ways. But two, in spite of the many, many, many advantages that I had compared to many, many others that come here, it's still a daunting process. A process who, in all sincerity, I don't wish to anyone to undergo alone. Well, here goes the personal, but when I was a little kid, my father, that good old man that I didn't understand until I got to grow up, really enjoyed football. And by football, I mean football. Not soccer. Not balompié. Yeah, I know. See that reaction? I love that. That's why I had to have some script just because, you know, out of respect and follow some stuff. But I love being more spontaneous than you can imagine. So this father of mine used to sit down with me and watch the Rose Bowl parade and watch college bowls with me every New Year's Day. Let me tell you what was important about that. Several times I remember as a little one, he looked at me and he said, "You know, son, I really hope that one day you go up there and you shine. I know you have what it takes to fly that high." Of course, that's my father talking. But it did leave a seed in me. And it definitely leave a seed of a positive image of this nation. So one can say that watching college bowls kind of helped me to dream of a different world. Funny thing is, when I came and knocked on the door of the University of Nebraska, and I eventually knew that I was privileged enough to be joining all of you here, I eventually went to Memorial Stadium. And one of the first things that I did in my loneliness was to call that man and tell him, "I couldn't make it before, but I am here. I'll try to make you proud. And I'll try to teach new generations of the things that I always wanted to know about." Another source for me to dream about this world came from my maternal grandfather. My maternal family has really humble origins. As a matter of fact, my mother was born in Tlaxcala. You just recently heard earlier today of that state, the land of corn, from one land of corn to another. My mother had a really rough childhood. It was hard for them to put a piece of meat on the table. My grandmother was a maid who cleaned different houses and washed other people's clothes so my mother could eat. My grandfather worked for the railroads until he decided to become part of an active movement of a union. And then the PRI regime chased him. He no longer has had a job, and he had to do something in desperation. I don't know the history of that, and trust me, I wish I can delve into it one day, but somehow he ended up in Kansas, working for the railroads. That man told me a few stories when I was a kid as well about coming to the United States. He was a charming man. He was an incredibly talkative person. And he always loved sharing his stories. He didn't have formal education, but until third grade, though. But he came to the U.S. and he told me two things about this place. He told me, you know, in the beginning, they didn't treat me really well because I'm very short, and they kind of mocked that. They called me Little Mouse. But eventually, he came to like that, and because he didn't know how to talk English really well, somehow he derived a mix of the word of English and Spanish of ratoncito into rantani. That's how that came to me as a kid. He's like, they would call me rantani. Help us here. Rantani, help us there. But then he took that with love. He got past that. And he realized that people looked something different in him, his willingness to put in the hard work all the time. All the time. And listening to his stories, I could realize that unlike where I had the blessing to be born, where my parents had to work, my father, 3 jobs at a time, most of the time, my mother, full-time, all the time, she doesn't even have a pension. She retired out of carpal tunnel. And she doesn't have a pension. And they don't have savings. They just have a house, the house that they built with more than 30 years of work. I knew that I didn't want that for myself. And trust me, I was very privileged there. I'll come to that in just a second. But just to give you a glimpse of that, if I have decided to do it, instead of standing here today, I probably would be standing in front of Congress. I'm 35 years old. I served under the most powerful man in Mexico, former President Zedillo, in his office, and under Vicente Fox's administration for the Undersecretary of the Federal Budget. I could have done just good for myself, but I didn't want to. I want my life to be more meaningful than that. So let me tell you about my first encounter with the heartland. Well, that happened in January of 1994. I came to Wausau, Wisconsin. Yes, Wausau, Wisconsin in January. And if you look it up, one of the coldest winters they have ever recorded. It was my first time seeing the snow. I ate the snow. I was delighted with that white thing. And now I cannot joke too much about it, because on my first time telling this story to a group of undergrads, I said, I love the white stuff. And they looked at me because I'm from Mexico, right? Let me tell you what changed my life on that trip. I landed in the U.S. for the first time January 10th, 1994, and I left 7 days later, January 17. I hold those dates really close to my heart. I was hosted by a Lutheran family, but they didn't say who they were, what they were. They just hosted me. Let me tell you what happened to me in the first dinner I had. Somehow, I'm the stranger, I'm the foreigner, and they asked Tommy, the little one of the family, to say grace. They all hold hands, I really didn't know what to expect. I swear, I don't mean this disrespectfully, especially now. But when they asked for my hands, I seriously thought the table was going to be lifted or something. I just didn't know what to expect. But the very first words that came out of Tommy's mouth were, "We give thanks for the presence of Sergio." Let me say that again, Sergio, because they couldn't say it as I was taught to say it in Spanish, Sergio. But regardless of how he pronounced it, and this is why I no longer correct people, and I actually introduce myself as Sergio, it's because I know that beyond the labels, those people that didn't know me cared. They thanked for my presence. They rejoiced in my presence, and I didn't have anything to offer. When I came back from that trip, I really wanted to give thanks for that trip. And at the time, surprisingly, coming from Mexico, I was not really a religious person. I grew up with a religious mother that never pushed any ideologies on us. But I really felt the need to go and give thanks for that family and the experience because I knew something inside had changed. It changed when the mother of the family put on me a red sweater with a W, sorry about that. And sorry to my fighting Alina back home too. But she said, "You know, Sergio, you would be an incredibly great international student, exchange student." Again, people that like you say different things, but it rang true inside me. I knew there was something about it that I wanted to pursue later on. When I came back to Mexico City, I wanted to give thanks for that experience. And I actually, on the oddest of these stories, I decided to go and give thanks. They used to attend a church called Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Wausau, Wisconsin. So I went to the phone book, and I looked for a Good Shepherd Lutheran Church. And guess what? There is. And not only that, it's listed in English, in Mexico City phone book. So I called, and I met one of my best friends today, Reverend Steve Hertzberg. I joined a bicultural church, and the rest is history. I had a chance to be exposed to genuine, generous Americans, not the leaders, not the ones who lead the charge, but those who actually care. Those who, like you, actually care. Almost every Sunday, because I was not that regular. I let Pastor Hertzberg down more often than not. But he was a great man, and he taught me one thing. I was first exposed to the issues of race and ethnicity in the U.S. because of him. He taught me a bit about it. He got into ministry because he wanted to help California, although he was born in Iowa, and here we go to the cornfields again. To have a better understanding in a multiracial setting. And one day he told me, because I told him, "I'm sorry if I disappointed you." And he said, "You will never disappoint me if, as long as you live, you can see in every single human being a brother or a sister, regardless of the color of their skin, regardless of their beliefs, even if they're not Christian. It is your Christian mission to love them all." I was exposed to the writings of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who became very consequential in my life, in my journey. And in a lot of ways, that's why, after a very, very insightful suggestion, the title of this talk became Pursuing the Dream. So let me hold back a little from the personal, because I don't want you to get bored. But I think you can already see the point of bringing those anecdotes to you. My first encounters with the United States were incredibly positive. I felt embraced, not rejected. That was not the story in customs, but let's leave it that way. The main idea is that I came, I was embraced, and I saw a different side. I started learning English when I was 5 years old. I went to Illinois to pursue my PhD. And given the chance to go back to Mexico or stay in the United States, I stayed in the United States because this is my home. Unlike those who were privileged enough to be born here, I chose this home. And that also takes commitment. Leaving everything behind takes a lot of commitment and love. But love, you should well know, is a two-way street. It's hard to love something that doesn't love you back. So I'm going to have to go very, very quickly, as you saw. And I have to cite this. Even though we must face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Martin Luther King. I am hopeful. I'm a scholar, but I'm a man of faith. And I am hopeful for this nation. And I want to be part of that change. So here it is. I have a few minutes left, and I know you have great questions, but I really need to share a couple of things here. Easing up the fears. I've said elsewhere that one of the main problems to push forward for a political, comprehensive political reform stems from the fact that people in both camps don't know how these will affect the balance of power. I have shown with my research, and it's research that is followed by others already, that at least Mexican immigrants, the bulk, are up for grabs. They're not ideologically tied to one or the other camps. So Democrats do themselves a huge disservice when they take Latinos for granted, Mexican immigrants for granted. Republicans shoot themselves on the foot by not reaching out to them earlier in the civic lives of America. I've said this before. My research actually shows that if nothing else, people standing on the right of the ideological spectrum are three times more likely to become partisans in the U.S. in the early years than those who stand in the left. But let me say aside of the fears, and I hope at some point politicians get past their fears, I want to tear down the walls. It is not by building walls in a border that we build friendship. So instead of building walls, I suggest the following. Why don't we simplify application procedures for immigration? Why don't we make more efficient temporary work programs? Why don't we allow for fast-track immigration routes for certain qualified individuals? After all, I've been in the United States for 7 years now. I'm fully fluent in English. I hold a PhD degree from one of the most prestigious universities. I teach the new generations of this country about their own political system. But I don't get the right to vote. I suggest that we have welcome centers, not walls. State-based. So people get to feel embraced as I once did. I suggest that we have English language programs because, yes, this is America and we speak English here. It's not like we don't want to learn English. I started when I was 5 and it takes a whole lot of time. And even when I came here, I still felt the headaches. I still felt the headaches of going back and forth in Spanish and English every single hour of the day. Why don't we have an adopting an immigrant program? Families adopting an immigrant for a year in the sense of exposing them to our cultural practices and exchanging cultural things. The Killians, that loving family that hosted me for 7 days, they were just as eager to learn about me as I was eager to learn about them. Obviously, this cannot be government imposed. And as somebody that fled a country that had the same ruling party for 70 years under which I actually served, I can guarantee you I'm suspicious of governmental efforts, but not from society-based ones. Why don't we let the caps in immigration flow determined by market, by supply and demand? This is America. This is the free market economy. But when it comes to immigration caps, we actually set them in stone in the law. Let the market speak. As for the so many millions of human lives that are undocumented living here. I had the opportunity to talk to several of them as part of my pilot study in Urbana-Champaign. And they would be willing to pay a fine in order to stay. And this is backed up by recent polls by the Pew Hispanic Center. Let's get a fine. The government needs the money. But most importantly, why don't we think of a community investments program? So all these politicians are worried about them sending back money to their homes. They send money back because they don't have the certainty whether they will stay or not. But if they're assured that they will stay, that this is their new home, they will invest in their new home. Let's give them that chance. I know I need to go, but this is why I was so afraid of coming to talk today, because I have so much to say, and I didn't know if I should. You'll be the best judges of that. Today, just let me tell you that I feel blessed to be an American. I feel blessed of having been born in Mexico. But I will feel more blessed when this nation reaches its full potential, and it will not reach its full potential without us, because us are part of them. Thank you very much.